Welcome back to season 3 of the Jane Q Public Podcast. If you're a loyal listener, you'll have already noticed that I've renamed the show and updated the format to focus on the central preoccupation of my life, which is the intersection of technology, civics, and American culture. I've got an incredible lineup of guests for this season, and I'm thrilled to be kicking it off with someone I've admired for a very long time. Omar Gayaga is a Texas-based freelance journalist who focuses on technology and culture. You'll have seen his byline in Wired, The Washington Post, Texas Standard, and of course, the Austin American Statesman, where he worked for more than 2 decades. Hello, Omar, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, I feel so honored to be here.
Oh, please.
No, really, I don't get invited on podcasts now that I don't have my own podcast anymore. Like, so I don't get to do this very often. Now I miss it.
Oh, wow, that sucks, because you're really good at this.
I think so. Sometimes I have my moments, but then, yeah, but then also I think podcasting is like a muscle that, you know, that atrophies if you don't use it enough. Cause when we were doing the I Love You So Much podcast, Tali Mosley and I, and our third host, that muscle was strong. Like I could just hop on and just do any, you know, talk up a storm, but like, yeah. It's been 3-4 years since that podcast ended. And yeah, I definitely feel like I'm not as, I know use words no good as well. Like back then.
You know, and I think the listener should be aware that in addition to being a journalist, you belong to a category of people that I'm going to call internet comedians.
Oh, okay. Sure.
I don't really know. Like, it's sort of a strange category because nobody's really actually making a living as an internet. Well, maybe some people are.
But oh, like, I know some people that are. They got book deals and video, you know, TV shows and stuff from their Twitter.
No, that's true. But for the most part, there are people that are just damn funny. And you are one of those. And you have been since way back, even before Twitter was a thing.
Oh, right? Yeah. I'm a member. I was a founding member of the Latino Comedy Project, which is a sketch comedy troupe out of Austin. And we started in 1998, a long time ago. I mean, I had just moved to Austin. I connected with Adrian Villegas, who is the artistic director. He was friends with Corey Coleman. He was roommates with Corey Coleman, who is one half of Double Toasted, which is its own like huge success story in Austin. Wow. of podcasting and video stuff, movie reviews that they do. So I connected with Adrian and auditioned for this comedy troupe in 1998 and have been involved ever since. We toured and done original shows. So like, yeah, my background is in sketch comedy primarily. Like that's what I like. I like writing. I like sketch. I've never did really improv or stand up. So my background is in the writing side of comedy.
And the other thing is that this is how I know you, actually. Mm-hmm. No, actually, we met on Twitter just because back in the day, because I'm going to revert into being like an old person. Back when Twitter first started.
You're reverse Benjamin Buttoning.
Well, you know, I'm almost 50 and I realize now just how alluring nostalgia can be. Like I used to wonder about like, why the hell are people so stuck in the past? But now I think back to those early Twitter years and we had a good thing going, especially in Austin. Like it allowed us to sort of cross streams a lot and meet people that we otherwise wouldn't in our own little silos. So you were one of those people. And of course you were working at the Statesman then, so everybody knew you.
I think it was self-selecting because the people that were there and on, in that little Twitter community early on, like 2007, 2008, were all curious and kind of tech savvy enough to know how to use it and kind of embrace it. But we were all sort of like nerdy and kind of curious and trying new things with it. So I think that was sort of the golden age of Twitter for us because everybody was treating it like, well, what are we going to do with this? And you know, this clearly there's some power here, but how are we going to utilize it? So like Michelle Greer was doing Twitter blood drives, and you know, we were all trying to figure out like what can we do beyond just saying what we had for lunch? Like how can we use this as a way to communicate in new ways? So like I think that group of people, you know, that I'm still friends with, I still follow everybody on Twitter and Instagram, and we're all Facebook friends, and we see each other in real life now and then. Like that was a really tight knit group of people. Like we're all still in each other's lives and hanging out online in some way or another. I mean, everybody has gone on to, you know, like get married, have kids, whatever, but we still keep up with each other.
Yeah, 100%. I feel the same way. And I'm sad. That's where the nostalgia comes in, that it's not an environment where that seems to happen very much anymore.
Not organically. You kind of have to curate your Twitter, you know, you have to spend the effort and time to curate your Twitter very carefully if you want that kind of experience.
Exactly. The thing I was going to bring up was I remember a friend of mine, the friend who actually got me on Twitter, she's the one that like urged me to join. When she found out that you and I followed each other, she freaked out because she was obsessed with you from Television Without Pity.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And if you have, like, for all of you people who are under 100, Television Without Pity was the best website. And it got me through some rough times, Omar. Like, I was obsessed with that site when I was home on bed rest with my twins. So you want to, can you please explain to the listening audience what that was and what your role there was?
Yeah, well, this came from, this goes way, way back to like the year 2000. but I became friends through the sketch comedy community with a woman named Pam Ribbon, who has gone on to become her own, you know, kind of universe and celebrity working out. But since she moved to LA, she's now a screenwriter. She helped write Wreck-It Ralph, the sequel. She co-wrote Moana. She's got her own TV show about to come out on FX. So like, she's a big deal. But at the time, she was an Austin writer and performer. She was with Monk's Night Out. And our circles, me with Latino Comedy Project, her with Monk's Night Out, our circles started to kind of converge. And there was some cross-pollinization and friendships going on. And I started following her blog, which was called Pammy.com. It still exists. And a friend of mine who I worked with at The Statesman named Heather Cox, who is also now a big deal. She is a co-author of The Royal We and a couple of other novels. And she's the co-creator of Go Fug Yourself, the website. I mean, all of these people who have gone on to do amazing things. And yeah, you know, we all kind of were in this little circle. She worked in the business desk of The Statesman. I worked at The Statesman. We became obsessed with Pam and reading her blog and following her stuff. And she was already recapping for a website called Mighty Big TV, which was very early pioneer of television recaps, of just very detailed, you know, 8,000-9,000 word recaps of a television episode. So they started as a Dawson's Creek website. They were called Dawson's Wrap. And it was Tara Ariano and Sarah Bunting, who continue to do podcasts and amazing stuff today. I'm still friends with them. And Dave Cole, who does a lot of the production side of things. So they were doing Mighty Big TV. Pam, I think, was doing recaps of, I don't remember what show it was. It might have been, I know she did Gilmore Girls for a long time, but there were other shows that she was covering, like Young Americans and some of those, like, you know, early, like late 90s, early 2000 WB shows. Mm-hmm. So we became obsessed with those recaps and we're like, we got to write for this website. This is amazing. Like, this looks so much fun. So Heather and I both pitched a set of TV shows to them that we wanted to cover. I think Heather got rejected a couple of times. I got brought in to do City of Angels, which was a weird show, a hospital show with Blair Underwood that no one remembers except me. But I enjoyed writing those recaps, and every recap I would mention Heather in every recap, like my dear friend Heather, because she would help like contribute jokes to the recaps and stuff, and until she got brought on. So she became a writer also for the website. So we had this really impressive band of people who were writing these recaps for Mighty Big TV, and eventually it got bought by Bravo, NBC, and they changed their name to Television Without Pity and continued to do this incredible set of, you know, TV recaps, very detailed work. I mean, I was doing Smallville for like 8 years for them, writing 8,000 or 9,000 words per episode week after week. It's just really good boot camp training for writers. And what came out of that, I mean, some of the people who were writing recaps for that website have gone on to do, you know, Linda Holmes of NPR was a recapper. She recapped the
really?
Yes, she could recap Survivor and a couple of other reality shows. I mean, yeah, Linda Holmes. That's how she got hooked in with NPR, was through Television Without Pity. Stephen Falk, who created the TV show You're the Worst, was a recapper for, I mean, like all these heavy hitter, talented writers who have gone on to do some pretty amazing stuff. So just to be in that group of these incredible up and coming, you know, comedy writers, basically people who are honing their comedic and pop culture chops, writing these recaps week after week, and then, you know, this huge forum community of fans and people who are reading the recaps. It was a really heady time. Television Without Pity, as much as I enjoyed my time at The Statesman, it was Television Without Pity that opened the doors to places like NPR, Rolling Stone. Like, that's where people heard about me, not from The Statesman. So a lot of the freelance success that came after was through that, not through The Statesman. So I owe Tara and Sarah and Dave a big, huge chunk of my career just because they opened those doors for us.
That's so interesting because, you know, what was I on? Oh, I was on the Trading Spaces and the, 7th Heaven. I don't know if you remember that show.
Uh-huh. It was a WB show. It was recapped, for sure.
It was awful. It was an awful show. And the pleasure I got was actually from reading the recap, which was so snarky. What's so interesting to me, though, is that it would take almost as much time to read a recap as to watch the show, depending on how quickly you were reading or how much time you could devote to it. And I don't know, like, that kind of reading online doesn't happen. Plus all of the time that you would spend discussing it in the forums. Mm-hmm. That is just, like, to take one little episode and spend 2 or 3 hours dissecting it, I just don't see that kind of thing happening, even on Twitter, where the, you know, where fans go and, you know, live tweet stuff. Maybe I'm just in the wrong place.
It was a huge time. So I think Reddit is sort of, it fills that void now where people go and just hours and hours are spent discussing things and dissecting them. But, you know, these were recaps that were like, you know, each page, you know, was more than a full screen. Some of these recaps ran 20, 25, 30 pages, you know, just, you know, click to the next page. People would print the, you know, would like screen grab them or print, you know, collect the text and print them out and save them. Like, I mean, I still hear from people who, you know, collected them as printouts and would read them, you know, like in the bathroom or whatever, they would just take them with them. I mean, I did that a couple of times where I would just print it out and just take it with me wherever I was going and read it like a book. Cause these were lengthy recaps, but for us, it was like, what value are we adding to that? Like, sure, you could just watch the show. The recaps had to be so funny and so entertaining in and of themselves that you would prefer to read the recap than actually watch the episode. And I recapped Smallville, which was a very earnest, you know, show that tried its best, like was never great. You know, it occasionally had flashes of inspiration where it would be kind of fun and silly. And, you know, my focus at Smallville, the first half of it, and I think until Michael Rosenbaum left the show as Lex, was just this intense homoerotic subtext of the show that people really, you know, the fans that watched the show were like, yeah, like, you, I mean, look at the way Lex is looking at Clark Kent. My goodness. Like, oh, wow. Like, there's some heat there. And whether that was intentional or not, like, it was there. Like, it was clearly like there was some undertones there. And I think what was interesting was that this was sort of the dawn of sort of the fan base and the recapping starting to inform the shows themselves. People who were writing these shows, creators were reading these recaps, and some of that stuff started to make its way back into those shows. So we're convinced that some of that what we call the ho-yay, the homoeroticism yay, you know, writing that we were, the dissecting that we were, you know, every week we're like, you know, I think I had the ho-yay look of the week, you know, like every week there was always some smoldering look between the two of them that I would highlight. We felt like that made its way back into the writer's room and that they started to kind of play into that. Like they started to make it a little more obvious and a little bit more textual. So that was interesting. An interesting time where, you know, people like Aaron Sorkin were poking into our forums and into like they're in seeing what we were saying. And clearly that stuff started to, by osmosis, absorb its way back into the TV shows themselves. So it was a really weird, interesting time where we were all trying to figure this out because that had never happened before. There was never a time when, you know, an online community was starting to influence the writing of these TV shows. Now it happens all the time. I think definitely writers room pay attention to Twitter and, you know, social media and how people are reacting and kind of calibrate or kind of course correct as they go. This was all new. You know, this was like really, you know, 2001, 2002, you know, shows like The West Wing. The idea that a show like The West Wing would, that Aaron Sorkin would go onto a forum and like, ooh, what are people saying about my show? Ooh, I don't like that. You know, I'm going to comment on my show about these stupid internet people. Like that actually happened. Like he actually came into our site, you know, looked at what was being said, did not like it, and then went and wrote an episode of West Wing where he made fun of basement dwelling, you know, chain smoking ladies, you know, whatever on the internet. Like it was like, why would you do that, Aaron Sorkin? But he did it. I'm not going to say it was drugs, but I'm not going to say it wasn't drugs. I don't know. You could take that out if you like.
It depends on how, if you ever intend on asking Aaron Sorkin for a job.
I interviewed him once. He's actually a really nice guy in person. Like I thought he was a delight. I interviewed him when The Social Network came out, and he was very, very nice to me. He was a very cool guy.
Well, you know, nobody wants to hear it. And also, I will say that the internet back in the day was not as rough, or at least not in the open spaces. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if people have a much thicker skin now, or they have to have a thicker skin now. So I can see sensitive Aaron Sorkin coming on your site and feeling a little miffed, but that's okay. We've all been there, Aaron Sorkin. We've all been there.
Oh, it's no fun to go somewhere on the internet and see everybody's talking about you and not saying nice things. Like that's, you know, I don't care who you are or how famous you are, that's gotta hurt. So I sympathize.
So one of the things that is so interesting about this conversation, and I want to use it as a segue into a larger conversation, is that one of the reasons why Television Without Pity was so great was not just about people giving opinions and writing. Because as we've seen, the internet is full of people who write and have opinions. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the content is quite low. And so, but back then, like you were saying, the kind of people that were attracted to that website or that were recruited for that website, the quality of their writing, the quality of their humor and their work was so good mm-hmm. that it really spoke for itself. It sold itself. I was hooked after the first recap, knowing nothing about the person that was writing it, right? Just because of the quality. And I think part of that too is that there weren't as many people online. That was even really before the blogging explosion. So the content that was being written for the web was less, and it was, in my humble opinion, better. So what I want to know is, are we better off with social media? We'll just speak about America, but are we better off or are we worse off since the dawn of social media, and in what respects?
Well, I miss online journaling. I mean, I was an online journaler. I was someone who 3 times a week wrote on my website, terribly happy about just whatever was going on in my life. And I linked to things I was working on. And I mean, it was my journal. It was for many years. And I always thought, you know, well, what someday my daughters will want to read this. They don't want to read this. I've learned since then that they have no interest whatsoever in what I write online. But at the time I was like, well, this is my journal. This is my life. This is what I'm doing. And, you know, there was a whole community of online journalers. You know, Pam was one of them who was influential to me. Greg Bueno, who lived in Austin, was one of the early pioneers of that. You know, there was a whole blogger community in Austin. You know, we hosted JournalCon one year in, I think, 2002, 2003. We hosted it, you know, pre-bloggers from all over the country come here. And so, you know, that was a community too. And I miss that. I miss these writers that I could just go to their website and see what was going on in their lives and kind of see what was happening. And, you know, and people got very personal. They shared tragedies. They shared all these very personal fears and anxieties and triumphs and things that were happening. And now you kind of get that on Twitter, you know, hey, I have a personal announcement. I'm taking a new job at wherever. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where all that has gone. So I don't think it's better or worse. I just think the medium has changed, and where the eyeballs are is different now. Now it's Facebook and Twitter, and you know, blogs still exist, you know, but I think now they take the form of newsletters. You know, I follow someone I met through the journaling blogging community was Liz Lenz. I met her very early on in her career when she was still doing like web stuff for a company. And I have gotten to follow her as she's become one of the nation's best writers on issues of feminism and motherhood and politics. Like, she's just become a superstar. But, you know, I met her at a blog her conference in like 2012 and have gotten to see her evolve from someone who was just sort of dipping their toes into online writing into someone who's written a couple of books and is now kind of internet famous and has an incredible Substack newsletter. So I think it's just where people are choosing to put their words and where you can build audience now. And I think places like Substack, Medium, where I wrote a lot over the last couple of years, it's just different locations. I don't think it's better or worse. I mean, I feel like I did some of the best writing I've ever done on Medium, mm-hmm. not on my own blog, not on my online journal, but like on Medium, I felt like I had the freedom to write anything. And I really took it very seriously. And I think I did some of the best work I've ever done in, like, you know, 2020, 2021, when I was, you know, cranking stuff out on Medium. So I don't think it matters where you're writing. I think it's the quality of the writing and how much passion you put into it. I see great tweets every day. I see tweets that I'm like, that deserves a Pulitzer. That is an amazing tweet. You know, I'm talking to you the morning after one of the hearings, one of the congressional hearings on January 6th. And the stuff I saw last night about Josh Hawley, some of the memes and some of the tweets I was seeing about it that were, you know, pretty instant reactions. Like, I'm like, that's amazing. Like, I'm so happy to be on Twitter and witness this kind of level of wit and discourse. You know, there's a lot of trash on Twitter, but there's also some real gems, some real gold that you find there every day. And it's just, I think if you curate your feed pretty carefully and you follow the right people, you're going to see great stuff day after day after day.
Yeah, I think that's the real key. It didn't feel like I had to put as much effort into wading through crap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Back then.
Signal to noise ratio is different.
Yeah. I guess that's what is frustrating is you have to expend. I think we all feel like we're already expending so much energy. And then in order to be able to actually use the web in a way that's useful, you have to expend energy to do that as well, right? To curate your feeds and to, like, there's all kinds of little tweaks. And many people have no interest in that or no knowledge about it, frankly, right? I'm shocked at how few people really understand even their own settings. Yeah. Profiles.
People don't generally do that.
Yeah. Yes, they just consume what's coming into their face.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's part of my concern, because back in the day, I remember us having an exchange on Twitter. It was very brief and it was very pointed. And the reason why I remember it was because it was an aha moment for me. And I remember you, I can't remember even the circumstances around it, but you were making a point about there's a difference between bloggers and journalists.
Yeah.
Right? Which is not to take away from either. And I feel like that I've actually clung on to that little nugget for a long time, because it's been sort of a touchstone for me as I'm consuming information online, you know, because so much is now it's just all in a big pot mixed together. You don't just have to curate your technology and your settings. You have to curate your mind and understand that certain pieces of information fall into different categories and should be weighed differently. So the way that we look at information now requires that we have a little bit more of a sophisticated outlook on what we're taking in. And this is not something that the average person is born with. And many of the platforms that we're on do not make differentiations. So we have to do that for ourselves. The onus is on us, right, to determine, you know, where's the source. An example would be if you wrote something for the Austin American Statesman, it would be subject to a whole different process, editorial process, than if you just wrote on your blog.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, this is all, I don't know what year that was that we had that exchange, but I'm sure my thinking has changed on it significantly, because I mean, at the time I was probably working at a newspaper for, you know, decades, and now I'm a freelance journalist with no boss, no oversight, no editors, you know, unless I'm working for an outlet that has its own staff of editors and copy editors and fact checkers. So like, my writing is all over the place now. Like, I mean, I might write for an outlet that has, you know, like a Texas Monthly that has fact checkers and editors and layers of stuff that my writing has to go through and gets vetted, you know, within an inch of its life. Or I might write something, you know, on Twitter or for Medium where nobody sees it. I just send it straight out into the public and no one looks at it except me. So I now deal with all levels of that, of, you know, a lot of editing versus no editing. And I think that might have been my larger point at the time about journalists versus bloggers, is that journalists at least have some sort of oversight. You know, they can get fired, you know, they can get reprimanded if they do badly. But increasingly, what's changed since then probably is that increasingly, a lot of journalists I talk to have very little oversight now. You know, they're mm-hmm. publishing straight to the web. They might have one assigning editor that looks at their copy and just sort of skims over it and, okay, this looks good, and sends it over. So I think those layers of copy editing, those layers that you had to get through to publish something in the journalism world, a lot of that has gone away at a lot of places. I mean, not everywhere.
Is that good?
No, I think it's terrible. I mean, I think when I was at the Statesman, I did have that autonomy once in a while. I had a blog called Digital Savant that was focused on tech, and I had been there long enough that they trusted me to publish straight to the web where an editor didn't have to look over my shoulder and read it. They knew that, you know, that I wasn't going to publish something stupid or libelous, that I, you know, that they trusted me enough to just publish something. And if something was wrong with it or it needed, you know, we would go back and fix it if something was amiss or I needed to add something or we got something wrong, which is rare. I mean, most journalists don't have that kind of freedom at a major newspaper to just publish straight to the web. Increasingly though, you're starting to see that because copy editing yep. desks have gone away. Assigning editors have a million things to deal with. So I think a lot of editors and reporters, once they get to a certain level, do have a little bit more leeway to, you know, I mean, most social media for journalism outlets don't have, you know, people publish tweets straight to social media. Nobody's looking at those. Nobody's editing tweets.
Exactly.
It comes straight from the social media editor or whoever. So I think more and more over time, there's less oversight and less layers to go through. Now, I'm not talking about your Washington Post, your New York Times, your Texas Monthlies. Yeah, yeah. Like, they still have those layers. I just did a story for the Washington Post and that went through weeks of editing, you know, many versions of the story that needed fact checking and sourcing and, you know, let's tweak this and let's add that. Let's talk to this person, double check this. So like that still happens. But I think especially at smaller outlets, at smaller media markets, less and less of that, more journalists are just sort of winging it and on their own, which is dangerous. I think, I mean, if you're a talented journalist, you're still going to get things wrong once in a while. So I think yep. the less of a safety net you have under you, the more likely you are to, you know, make a big mistake.
Well, and I think sometimes it's just a typo, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I see it in legit news sites, right? Or, you know, especially like you said, the local stuff. It's like, wow, did anybody read this? But the other thing is, because those lines are so squishy or so gray right now, I feel like we're in a place where it's hard to know truth, right? Because we can shop for our truth and find what you want to find someone that confirms any of your biases. You can go online and you can find it, right? And it doesn't matter to a lot of people whether or not an actual journalist who was trained, educated in journalism produced it. It doesn't matter to a lot of people whether or not it went through an editorial process. Mm-hmm. People are outside of professional media are looking at information, and very little effort is put into analyzing where it's coming from.
Oh, I don't think most people do that. I mean, I don't think most people are super media literate. I mean, all the things I just talked about, I don't expect people to know any of that. Yeah. I don't expect people to make the distinction between an outlet that has tons of editing versus an outlet that has no editing. I don't think people really make that distinction or understand that. And one of the things I've tried to do my whole career was be very transparent about how I do my job. You know, if people ask me, where'd you get that idea? How did you do the story? I'll tell them. I mean, I have no problem revealing my process and how I source and how I do stories. But there's a lot of media outlets that keep that stuff under wraps. And sometimes it's for a good reason. You know, if you're doing an investigative story, you don't want someone else to scoop you. You don't want to reveal information that might get people to lock down other information. You know, if you're dealing with government sources or shady people, you don't want them to go destroy their records at the minute they hear that you're doing a story about it. So there's good reason sometimes to keep things under wraps. But as far as just how newsrooms work and how we do our jobs, like, there's no reason to hide that stuff behind a curtain. There's no reason not to be transparent about this is how we collect news. This is how we put it together. This is how we edit it. People should know that. The larger issue, though, I think, is that most people don't care. Most people are not interested, don't care. You know, it's shop talk. And, you know, I'm part of one of my gigs these days is I do a lot of work with Pointer, which is the nonprofit association for journalists. I do a lot of coaching and I'm lead advisor for a fellowship that we do. So I'm dealing with a lot of young journalists who are just, you know, on their second or third job. They're 2 to 5 years into their first reporting gigs. And, you know, they're dealing with a public that does not trust them, does not care how they do their jobs, is not interested in, you know, the behind the scenes, but I still try to urge them, like, be transparent about what you do, because, you know, the more, even if you just educate one reader on how newsrooms work and how journalists work, that's still one person who's going to know that, you know, it's still valuable. And I think the last data I saw was like 2 out of 10 people have ever actually met or interacted with a journalist. They don't know what we do. They don't know how we do our jobs. Right. So I think I always try to tell people, like, you know, tell the reader what you don't know. If you're doing a police story and they've only given you black suspect 6'10", you know, which is not going to help catch anybody. You know, if there's a crime story, police, tell the reader, this is all the police gave us. This is all that we know. We asked. Yeah. We asked the police and they didn't give us any more information. Like, tell the reader that. You don't have to hide that or pretend that you have authoritative information when you don't. So I always advise people, like, tell the reader what you don't know, because sometimes that's important to know as well.
The other kind of funky and disturbing part of this equation is that anyone can now go, cough, cough, Huffington Post, create a website, make it look like a newspaper aesthetically. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff on that website that is just not journalism. I'm sorry.
Oh, it goes right? Beyond that. There was a whole story in the New York Times last year about this company that was creating fake websites meant to look like city guides, meant to look like your Austin 360s or whatever, and completely fake. And, you know, that allowed politicians to buy stories, basically touting their good work or smearing their opponent. And they were designed and made to look like publications from these different towns. Very nefarious. I mean, that goes, you know, one or two steps beyond the Huffington Post model, where they're not even pretend, you know, they're not even trying to be legit. These are clearly pop-up, you know, websites meant to just smear political opponents or promote certain politicians or businesses.
Yeah, totally. And I think that that's part of, a few weeks ago, there was some polling that came out about how little faith Americans have in any of our institutions anymore. I don't think there's any institution in America that has more than 25% of whatever the you know, people would believed in or thought was legit. And you know, journalism, the fourth estate, has always been and will always be an essential part of democracy. And yet, you look at what was once this beautiful, austere fourth estate, and now there's, it's, you know, the lawn is covered with pup tents and trailers and people, you know, tailgating. And it's just, and there are people that are, you know, as you know, actively trying to undermine faith in journalism and media. And so, I mean, this is where I get very, very nervous, is that we need information. We need good information, and we need information that comes from sources that we can trust. And at the same time, it's very easy for anyone to go on and position themselves as an outlet like that. And there are people that are trying to undermine our faith in this entire process and make everything completely relative. I don't think it's a coincidence that the faith and trust that people have in media has gone down at the same time that everyone on Earth and their dog can produce media. You know what I'm saying?
But I also don't share that rosy eyed view of what journalism used to be, because I've been in journalism for 25 odd years, I was doing newspaper journalism, you know, high school and college. So like, I've been at this for a long time and have seen it evolve. And I know that this period that we're talking about, where people trusted, you know, subscribed to newspapers and trusted the news, journalism had issues back then too. You know, like there were some bad players back then too. There were some, you know, and newsrooms were largely, you know, and still largely, especially in TV, run by white men. You know, like that's still, you know, I think in TV news, it's still 79-80% white male managers, you know, at TV stations. So they're driving the news content. So like, I don't have that rosy view of like, oh, the good old days of journalism. No, it's always been broken in some form or fashion. It's always been, there's always been internal issues about, you know, keeping down disenfranchised voices and, you know, serving business interests. Like, there's always been shady shit going on in journalism. So I don't share that view of, you know, wish we could go back to the old days when everybody trusted news. They trusted news, and sometimes news was not worthy of being trusted. It was a lot of yellow journalism and stuff going on. But yeah, so I'm very cynical about that. And I've worked with in environments where I saw some of that firsthand, you know, of racism and sexism and just bad dealings. And it's definitely gotten better. As I talk to these younger journalists, definitely more diverse points of view, definitely better hiring practices, but we still got a ways to go. So I'm always going to hold journalism to a higher standard of like, oh, we could always be doing better. It's never been perfect.
I completely agree with that. You know, I'm not rosy glass wearing fool, but I also feel like this is a double-edged sword. While I do see that, you know, the new media ecosystem is giving younger journalists, women, people of color, especially women of color who are journalists, a platform and an opportunity to criticize the institutional flaws of journalism. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, it's also giving a cutting edge to people who truly want to leverage the public faith for something bad.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of that.
So to me, I'm like, how do we keep the good and at least marginalize the bad? And there doesn't seem to be a good way to do that.
I don't know. I think journalism is struggling right now with for the last 20 years that I've been in the business, it's been about how do we survive? How do we monetize? How do we, you know, continue to operate without going out of business? And I think, you know, we've seen some new models that have worked, like Texas Tribune, I think, is a great example of like, let's not do things a traditional way. And it's in terms of, you know, how the newsroom is structured and how we finance it. So some of those experiments have been great. You know, I'm a big fan of, you know, the Texas Tribune. I'm a big fan of the 19th, you know, both based here. I think they're doing great work and have figured out something that other, you know, some of the major news organizations have not. But at the same time, I've watched, you know, the paper that I worked at go through, you know, two or three different owners. You know, we were owned by Cox and then Gatehouse and now Gannett. I still say we, even though I don't work there anymore. and the other part of the coin is, you know, we've had this movement against journalists, you know, an increase in violence against journalists, lack of trust in journalists, you know, the whole fake news movement that Trump kind of led. And so I think I definitely agree it's a double-edged sword in that, like, when you democratize news, when you give everybody a platform, when you give everybody the opportunity to do a podcast or a newsletter or, you know, create their own website, there's going to be a lot of junk out there. But I think also, you know, what I'm seeing that's encouraging is some people being brought into journalism through independent blogs or independent, you know, like newsletters, or people who just get really good at self-teaching themselves how to do this stuff and then getting picked up by, you know, your Washington Post or your New York Times, like, hey, this person is very talented. They've learned it all on their own somehow. And, you know, we should help them hone those skills. And so I'm seeing some of that. Some people entering journalism through not the non-traditional route where you don't go to the journalism school and you don't study, you know, for 4 years at college or whatever. Like, I've seen more people enter through blogging, through podcasting, through doing good TikToks and a media outlet says, hey, we need a TikTok person. Let's bring that person on. I think that's the smart way to go. I think when news outlets realize, like, we need to broaden what we do and who produces that content beyond just, you know, the 4-year bachelor degree person, you know, or Ivy League person. I think that just is better. And I think that does help build trust in community. When people see people working in newsrooms that came up through other means, you know, not through the traditional college route, I think that sort of fosters community too. If people say, oh, wow, that person did it, or that person who I was already following independently, you know, through their own thing, like, wow, now I should subscribe and read their stuff there. Hopefully that works.
Let me ask you this. So one of the reasons why I changed the name of this podcast is I do consider myself the average person, right? I'm just middle-aged American woman who is trying to make her way in the world, right? All of that kind of just, I don't know a lot, right? And I'm willing to admit that, but I have concerns. And I also feel like it's a responsibility as part of, you know, as a member of a democracy to be informed and to understand issues as best I can and to make whatever contributions I can to the greater good. And so for me, I would like to hear from you, as someone who has been a journalist for decades and who has so much experience, not just in professional journalism, but in the larger media ecosystem, what advice do you have for people like me in making sure, right? Because there's so much and I have to make choices. I can't just sit online all day or stick it in my arm like an IV. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to make choices and I need to be able to make discretionary choices, basically. What advice do you give me as I log in every day and am hit with basically a fire hose of information that my brain literally is not made to digest and still be able to trust what I'm getting and act on it in a way that is beneficial for our society?
Oh, wow.
That's a huge question. Yeah. I know. But surely you have some tips.
I mean, this goes back to media literacy. I mean, I think you sell yourself short in that I think you're way more media literate and more world savvy than most people who I think are consuming news. I mean, I think you understand how the world and journalism works a lot better than most people. But as far as, you know, good habits and kind of how to kind of deal with the fire hose thing, I always tell people, like, pay attention to the bylines a little bit. You know, like, if you see something you really like that was written for, you know, like the Washington Post or wherever, like, who wrote that? Like, pay attention to who that person was that wrote it and maybe start following them on Twitter or follow that person's stuff, you know, like, just start reading other things that they wrote. I mean, I'm very much of the belief that, like, if you like someone's writing, like, you should support it and follow them and kind of see, you know, kind of keep up with what they do. I've been lucky and blessed that there's people who seem to like my stuff and you know, continue to read what I do. And, you know, I post everything I do on social media, everything I have that's published, you know, wherever it's published, I post it on Twitter, I post it on Facebook, I post it on Instagram sometimes. So people who follow me on those social media platforms know what I'm working on or know what I've got out there, you know, and that's how I know when, you know, like when Liz Lenz writes something, I see it in her newsletter or I see it, you know, mm-hmm. on her Twitter. When I see Alexander Petrie from the Washington Post has a new column out. And the other thing that people I don't think do enough, even within newsrooms, I this drove me crazy at the Statesman because I noticed that this just wasn't happening, is that when people do good work, you know, share it. You know, when you see something that touches you or that you think is good information, like, pass it on to other people. You asked earlier, you know, how do you know where to find this stuff? I mean, apart from just curating my social media so I'm following good people that I trust, I also get a lot of good stuff from, you know, my friends. You know, my brother sends me stuff on Twitter. You know, we're direct messaging each other several times a day with links to things like, oh, look at this. Oh, this movie's coming out. Check it out. You know, like we're sending each other messages multiple times a day with like, oh, look at this funny meme. Oh, look at this video. Oh, look at this. So a lot of the stuff I get or stuff that I share is from my brother or from other people that I trust. And we're continually just sending good stuff to each other. And that could be, you know, a good news story. I mean, like, you know, when Alexandra Petry came back from her hiatus and posted this thing about, I think she posted the Webb telescope, you know, all the pictures. She posted it as food I would like to eat, like ranked as how tasty each of these things looks, you know, which clearly is like, she just came back from maternity leave, you know, brain's a little scrambled, but it was the funniest thing I had read like that whole week. And I shared that with everybody. Like I shared that with my brother, my friends, like my dad, like, I mean, I sent that to everybody that I thought would get a laugh out of it because it was so funny. So when you see good stuff like that, I mean, that's the other part of it. And like I said, when I was at the Statesman, it drove me crazy that journalists were not sharing good work from other journalists that they worked with. You know, you're literally sitting, you know, two rows away from the person who just wrote this amazing thing and you're not sharing it with anybody. That really bothered me. It's like, why are you not supporting the people you work with by spotlighting the good work that they're doing every day? Like that really, and I continue to do that. You know, when I see something good from the Statesman, from writers that I like, you know, like your Eric Webbs and Deborah Sengupta Stith and Matthew Odom. I mean, I still have friends over there who I think do amazing work and I try to share their stuff as often as I can. You know, when they write something that I really enjoy, I pass it on. So I think that's the other piece that is often missing. And, you know, journalists are terrible about promoting their own work. We just are not good at it. It always feels weird to us to toot our own horn and say, like, go read my stuff. It feels a little desperate at times. And a lot of journalists just don't do it. They don't promote their own work. They don't promote other people's work, you know, because they feel like it's, I don't know, there's some stigma there. About self-promotion and that it feels too much like marketing, which journalists don't like to be seen as marketers.
Absolutely.
So, but it makes sense. But it's important.
You're not a marketer. You are a journalist. I totally.
But it's important to build your brand, and it's important to help the brand that you're working for. You know, because if you don't, like, that way lies bankruptcy. Honestly, so
understood.
Yeah. So I always encourage people to, like, if you see something good, don't just sit on it, you know, share it with somebody or post, retweet it, whatever, get the word out that there's good work being done out there.
You know, it occurs to me as I'm listening to you, why I have appreciated your contributions so much over the years. And you just made the point beautifully in that last little segment that you humanize information. And I think so much of our shenanigans that occur in the modern world are because we try to automate and defer to technology so much of our activities, right? And what you've always done is say, no, the information is good, but it's also the people that are producing it. And it's also the ecosystems and the networks and the friendships that you have that contribute to the value of the information itself. To me, it just, you know, I had this light bulb moment because that is also something that I really worry about a lot is the dehumanization that happens online and this sort of the ease with which everything is just sort of turned into a flat line, right? Everything is everything. Everything is the same. And you're saying that in order to combat that, you reframe your information intake around people. Or at least that's what I feel like you're saying. And I feel like that's incredibly valuable advice. I mean, I can't think of a more valuable piece of advice, frankly.
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, that's exactly right. That I always look at who's making this thing and how can I support them? And, you know, I'm on a couple of Patreons, you know, where I support, there's a comic strip that I like that I support. There's a couple of podcasts, you know, Liz's Substack, things like that, where like, I am a fan of this person. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure they're able to keep doing what they're doing, whether that's financially or just in terms of, you know, me clicking on it and giving them page views or retweeting their stuff. If I'm your fan, you know, I'm going to let people know about stuff that you're doing that I think is cool. And in terms of the journalism part of things, of you know, trying to humanize tech. I mean, that's always been my ethos from when I started, was like, I don't care about how the car works. I care about where the car is going to take you. I don't care about how, you know, how fast the processor is. I care about what are artists going to be able to do with a fast processor like that. So my work has always been focused on, we got this technology. This is very cool and all, but what are we going to do with it? And how is it going to be? How is it going to affect us, good and bad? And that I think in tech journalism, the thing that I was always mindful of was, I'm not here to just tell you how cool a technology is. I need to tell you also, what's the possible harm? You know, where could this lead us? You know, what's the downside of some of this technology? And I think that's often missing in tech journalism, where people are just basically writing marketing copy for the latest whatever. You know, and I think we're seeing that play out with Tesla, with Elon Musk, this whole love affair that tech bros have had with Elon Musk, and how little, you know, over time, these last 2-3 years, we've seen that onion peeled back and getting to see who Elon Musk really is. It's like, oh, wow, there was a lot here that, you know, and I think he still has, you know, supporters and people who hail him as a hero and are never going to hear a bad word against him and believe it. You know, they're going to continue to support him. But the rest of us who are like, whoa, this guy, wow, like there's some stuff going on here psychologically. And I mean, like, he is not the tech hero and savior that we thought he was maybe, you know, 10 years ago when people were like, wow, Tesla, great idea. You know, let's support this. So that's always been my focus in on the journalism side of things, is like, not just what's the technology, but like, what is it good for and how is it going to benefit us or hurt us? And my editors would always tell other people like, oh, Omar writes about, you know, tech that your grandma could understand or your mom could understand. It's like, no, that's not it. That's not quite what I'm trying to do. I want everybody to be able to understand it and everybody to be able to grasp like what's the significance of whatever, you know, whatever technology is coming along. And if when I look back at my career over the stories that I've done, my favorite stories that I've done have been about the people, have been about, you know, the person who had ALS and was able to draw with his eyeballs, you know, was Francis Tsai, who is an Austin artist, who was able to adapt to continue to create original artwork when he lost the use of his arms and legs and was able to do it, you know, with eye tracking software. Like, that's one of my favorite stories I've ever done. I did a story early in my career about Gordon Matthews, who was sort of the inventor of voicemail and kind of all the regrets he had about inventing voicemail. You know, when I look back on what are my favorite stories, it's stories like that. Like, who is the person behind this thing and who is the person that's innovating and what are they about?
Yes, exactly. You're so exemplary in the way that you go about your work, and so transparent. And this is the kind of thing that makes me feel hopeful, is that there are solid people out there doing good work and who understand both the positives and the negatives of, you know, the kinds of technologies that we're using and how they're impacting us, and that are committed to helping us think through these things, right? And it isn't your job. You're right. It isn't your job to tell me what to think, but you do need to give me all the information so that I know what I'm dealing with, so that I can think things through. I don't need to be propagandized, right? And I feel like so much of what's on the web is either marketing or propaganda. You know, I have so much respect for the kind of work that you do and the way that you do it. We have a few minutes, just a couple of minutes actually left. And so I want to close on a up note. You have 2 daughters. I have a couple of kids myself. I log on every day and I see a lot of people, you know, pulling their hair, gnashing their teeth, rending their garments or whatever. And I want to know what makes you hopeful for America.
I mean, definitely my kids, just seeing them, how smart they are and how savvy they are about things already, you know, things that I had not figured out. By their age, they're 12 and almost 15. And, you know, my older daughter is very into music. So she's, you know, already composing music and playing all these different instruments. And like, that's not a skill I ever picked up. So like, just seeing her develop as a musician, as someone who's a band nerd and, in, you know, and all that, like, I love seeing that she found her thing at an early age. You know, I found my thing in writing at 13. So like, to see her latch onto something and go, that is my jam. That is what I'm into, has been really wonderful. My younger daughter, though, is more like, she's good at everything. It feels like she's good at a lot of different things. And it just like, just waiting for her to sort of like ping in one direction and go, oh, that's my thing. She hasn't figured that out yet. Everything she tries, I think she's great at. Like, she's so creative and entrepreneurial and figures things out. And just the way her synapses work in her brain, like, she just figures it out real quickly. So that gives me a lot of hope that they're going to be fine. You know, like I'm going to try to be their dad as much as I can and help them out when I can. But like, I have faith in both of them figuring stuff out because they've already proved that they're good at that. In journalism land, like this whole stuff that I'm doing with Pointer, like I'm interacting with all these young journalists in this fellowship. That gives me hope. And I've been doing that for about 3 or 4 years where I, you know, different, every year it's a new class of young journalists, and just having conversations with them, just listening to their struggles and what they're working on and how energetic and ambitious they are about the kinds of things they want to be doing. That gives me hope for journalism. If we can just keep them from getting burned out, if we can just keep them in the industry and keep them from, you know, quitting in frustration because they're not getting paid enough or they're getting disrespected or they're just not being treated well. Like, I'm constantly trying to advocate for those journalists to kind of stand up for themselves, because I remember being in my 20s in a newsroom and just being ignored and being like, not always being listened to or treated well. And I'm like, you know, that has to change. But when I see these journalists, you know, like not give up and continue, and even though they're overworked and underpaid and dealing with a hostile public, they still keep going and they still keep doing the job. So that gives me a lot of hope. Just talking to them, I'm like, I don't have the energy to deal with that stuff anymore like you guys do. But to see you continue on and still want to learn more and absorb these lessons that we're trying to give you, that gives me a lot of hope for journalism, is seeing this next generation of journalists come up and continue to do good work and be much more aware of things like diversity and disenfranchised voices. Like, yep. They're so much more aware of that than I was at their age as a journalist, you know, in the, you know, early 2000s and late 90s. Like, they are so much more humanistic in their approach than we were at the time. So like that all gives me warm fuzzies. And I think as long as we continue to bring up these journalists and continue to empower them, there'll still be great journalism being done going forward.
Wonderful. Beautiful. Now I'm
they're good. They're great young journalists that's, you know, I when people say, oh, journalism's dying, newspapers are dying, it's like, no, they're not. I mean, newspapers might go away, but good journalism's not going to go away.
I think we need to stop focusing on form and look at function and recognize that the value is again, as you said, in the people, right? It's in the people. And whatever form journalism takes, and technologically or otherwise, it's still going to be produced by people. So yeah, 100% agree. Thank you, by the way.
It's so rewarding. I write a lot less these days because I'm, you know, so much of my time goes to that, but it's been such a good trade-off. You know, I don't miss the time that I've lost from, you know, doing this, because I think it really yields some great rewards, just being able to encourage them and keep them going and tell them you're doing good work. Don't give up. Like, don't, you know, if no one else is telling you you're doing great work, I'm here to tell you you're doing great work. Like, just keep going. I get a lot of joy from being able to tell them
that. Omar, thank you for being so generous with your time. This has been such a great conversation. I am going to need some time actually to digest it, because I have a lot to think about.
Well, I'm hard to digest sometimes, so I understand that. I am not an easy swallow as far as
people are. I think you're just fantastic and charming.
Well, I think I'm a delight, but I know some people online hate my guts. Like I don't like that guy. He's annoying. So like, I get it.
Oh, please. If anybody says that, you just send them to me. I will set them straight.
Oh, okay.
I have no interest in hearing Omar Gaga get shit talk.
I did have an internet hater one time who actually is a politics person in town. I'm not going to say his name, but you would know it if I told you who it was. Mm-hmm. And we got into a Twitter tiff, a Twitter, you know, battle or whatever. And I berated him, and I'm kind of known for being like a good Twitter wrangler, like with trolls. I'm tenacious and don't let go until I've won them over. And we got into it so bad that people in the newsroom were like, are you okay? What's happening here? And eventually he sent me a box of Tiff's treats to, you know, to make up for our argument. Like, that's how much I won him over, was he actually sent me a box of Tiff's treats to my newsroom. And then we were friends. So
you got Tiff's out of a twiff.
Yeah, out of an online tiff treats. But I have a reputation for dealing with trolls online, to the point where like one of my editors was finally like, Omar, you got to stop engaging with these people. This is a huge waste of your time. I was like, okay, fine.
All right. I hope you'll come back again sometime, and I hope I get to see your face in person at some point.
I know. I would love to see it. I so admire what you do online, and I think we were supposed to do this a few years ago.